It's the Merlin, and took the opportunity to speak to our Raptor Conservation Officer, John Lusby, again, who's been doing a lot of work on Merlin the last few years. And yeah, over to the interview with John. It's very, very interesting stuff. Hiya, John. Welcome back to In Your Nature podcast. Thanks a million for joining us again.
Thanks a lot, Ricky. Delighted to be back for a second time running, so my pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's great. And this time, obviously, you're our Raptor Conservation Officer in Birdwatch Ireland. So we're talking birds of prey and raptors again, which is great. And it's always a very popular topic. But this time, we're leaving the barn owls behind and we're talking about a dainty but lethal little falcon. And that's the Merlin.
That's right, yeah. So probably refer to it as the forgotten child when it comes to raptors in Ireland. But that shouldn't be the case. An absolutely amazing bird. So it's our smallest bird of prey in Ireland, diminutive falcon, but absolutely fantastic bird, incredibly agile, and a bird of upland habitats, but one that we don't know a lot about. It's probably, I think, our most widespread species of raptor and an Annex 1 species that we know least about. And so we've been trying to make an effort in recent years to try and change that. But it does take some time. A tricky species to work on, but a very important one nonetheless.
Okay, so let's go back to the basics, because I've been at this a good while now, and it's a bird that I'm not even familiar with to any great extent. So let's go right back to the basics. So can you describe the appearance and what sort of size, when we say dainty and this, like, diminutive and use terms like that? I mean, what are we talking? Are we talking the size of a sparrowhawk or smaller, or where are we?
No, so much smaller than a sparrowhawk. So essentially, and people are always amazed at the size of these birds, and particularly the males. So Merlins display reverse sexual dimorphism. So that's where the females are larger, and noticeably larger in the case of Merlin, than the males. So the male being the smaller bird, so to compare it to another bird, it's just slightly larger than a blackbird. So to put that in context, very, very small for a bird of prey. The female obviously being a little larger than that. So the male would be just about 150 grams or a little bit more. So very, very small bird. And I suppose one that, yeah, a lot of people wouldn't be familiar with. People would see them more at this time of the year outside the breeding season, so during the autumn and winter. And that's when Merlin would mostly occur along the coastline or, you know, around wetland areas. And also as well, we get an influx of birds, of migrants, Merlin from Iceland as well, during the autumn and winter. But then during the breeding season, Merlin would typically occur in more remote areas, so our uplands, so areas which are important for Merlin, places like, you know, the Blanket Bogs of Connemara, the Wicklow Mountains, those areas. And during the breeding season, they're very difficult to find. They very much go under the radar. So even though they're there, you know, people, you know, they wouldn't be very, very, very frequently seen. And I think because of that as well, you know, they tend to go under the radar a lot. So that's Merlin in terms of their distribution.
Okay, so you mentioned, that their habitats are sort of montane or upland blanket bogs. I suppose in the UK they would refer to moors a lot as their habitat. And what I suppose moorland, we don't really use the term here, but it's basically grazed blanket bog, isn't it? There's more species in there. It's a bit grassy. It's probably been grazed a bit, something like that. Then we find them then down in the coast, because why did it move? Is it just gets too harsh up the mountains, or are they falling prey, or what's the dynamic?
Well, that's it. Yeah, I suppose the weather conditions, obviously, you know, quite challenging in these upland areas, you know, which are up to reasonably high altitudes, up to 500-600 meters. So obviously the weather, you know, during the autumn and winter, but also as well, if you think of the uplands, you know, they're bursting with life during the spring and summer. You know, we have species like meadow pipit, skylark, but a lot of those species would move down to the lowlands during the autumn and winter. So then obviously the prey species, which Merlin depend on, you know, they are much reduced in numbers in the uplands. So it would make sense for them, you know, to follow the prey, essentially, to move down to areas where there is greater prey availability, and that would be the case, you know, along coastal areas and wetlands. They also take, you know, small waders and other species, and then obviously return, you know, kind of at the early stages of the spring, you know, to re-establish territories and to pair up for the coming breeding season. And other species would do the same, you know, the likes of hen harrier and other species which would use their uplands typically, you know, would move down to the lowlands during the harsher months.
To tell me, so you mentioned waders, they're small waders. You're probably talking like stuff small, like Dunlin and Sanderling perhaps, and stuff like that, real small lads. So it's meadow pipits and skylarks predominantly them when they're up the mountains, I guess, and on the bogs.
It is, yeah. And even they would take snipe as well, and probably more so the female Merlin being that bit larger would take snipe, you know, in the uplands and during the breeding season. And sorry, I suppose when I say the uplands, that they also occur in the, you know, the raised bogs, you know, in Midland counties as well. But it's in terms of prey, it's those two that you mentioned. They're the mainstay of the Merlin diet, is skylark and meadow pipit.
What about, John, do they bother with mammals or insects at all?
So they do. They take moths, and moths would be an important part of the diet. So they take day flying moths. They can also take dragonflies and other species. So and we know this. We've looked at Merlin diet. There's not that many things that are easy to study when it comes to Merlin, but one of those things is looking at their diet, because they leave their prey remains behind in the form of pluckings. So when they catch prey, they typically pluck them, whether it be the wings of moths or, you know, the feathers of the birds that they catch before they either feed on them or bring them back to the typically bring them back to the nest to feed the young. So they have, you know, regular perching posts where you see this build up of their plucked prey remains, and then obviously you can tell what they've been feeding on. So yeah, so day flying moths are, you know, important in the diet, but it's mostly the small birds, and those two in particular, meadow pipit and skylark, which would be the most important parts of the diet for Merlin.
They've got an interest in breeding ecology for a small raptor in that they'll nest on the ground.
Well, to be honest with you, I've never come across a ground nesting pair of Merlin in my time in Ireland. So there seems to have been, and I think, you know, for all we know of Merlin, it seems to be very, very rare nowadays of birds nesting on the ground in heather moorland. Obviously, it's still prevalent, you know, and say you mentioned Great Britain, and, you know, where they've, you know, grouse manage more, and there's, you know, huge swathes of areas, you know, with you know, where it's managed for the heather, like the Merlin still nest on the ground in deep heather. But in Ireland, there seems to have been a shift in their nesting ecology, kind of going back from probably about the 1970s on. So traditionally, Merlin would have nested on the ground in deep heather. But more recently, you know, and due to changes in the uplands, they now are predominantly nesting trees. And if you think, you know, there's been huge changes to our upland habitats. So, you know, obviously overgrazing, you know, the loss of heather moorland, but also, you know, as that was happening, also the increase in afforestation, so the increase in, you know, commercial conifer plantation in these areas, you know, which are important for Merlin, particularly in our upland areas.
And probably a lot more in that predator guild here than would be on grouse moors in the UK, because the gamekeepers keep anything that's sort of, you know, interfering with the grouse would be dead. So there'd be no foxes or probably stoats and all that sort of stuff. But here they'd be encountering all those in the blanket box.
Absolutely, yeah. And I suppose like with a lot of our species, you know, very different situation between, you know, populations between Ireland and across the water. And actually, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that studies previously in Britain did show a difference in breeding success between pairs nesting on the ground and pair nesting in trees, likely linked to, you know, mammalian predation. So now, yeah, we have an interesting situation that Merlin, and they don't build a nest themselves. So that they take over, they use a disused and old stick nest, usually that of a hooded crow, sometimes magpie. So there's somewhat, it's an interesting relationship, but somewhat reliant on those species, on those corvids, you know, to provide suitable stick nests. And mostly nest now in trees, often, you know, in conifer plantations, at the edge of conifer plantations, but also as well, you know, in smaller groups of trees and copses and shelter belts. And in Connemara, they're very interesting nest sites on the small, densely wooded islands on the lakes. So that's not to say that there aren't ground nesting pairs left in Ireland, and I'm sure there are, but I don't think there has been one found for quite a few years now.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so that begs the question, you mentioned plantation forestry there, and that they've also adapted to no longer nest on the ground in Ireland. So would it be safe to say that afforestation has forced them into those young plantations, and they've adapted to that in Ireland, but maybe not as much elsewhere?
I think that's fair to say, yeah. I think it's a combination of loss of suitable ground nesting conditions, and then at the same time, you know, large swathes of the uplands being planted, and this, you know, this new forest resource being available to them. So I think it's a combination of both. I mean, it is interesting. There are definitely some areas that I have seen where there are still suitable ground nesting conditions, at least as far as I can see, but merlin are tending to nest in trees. So I think, you know, in the UK they've seen as well that, you know, there has been a similar switch, at least in certain parts of the UK, not throughout the UK, where birds have switched from mostly from nesting on the ground to nesting in trees. So it is an interesting situation. It's one as well, it's a strange relationship, strange dynamic, because obviously now in certain areas, you know, merlin are somewhat reliant on nesting in trees and on conifer plantation, but they essentially, apart from nesting in the plantation, they don't forage, they don't, you know, use the plantation forest for anything else. So it kind of, you know, it's potentially a situation whereby once there are suitable nest sites available, you know, the extent of forest cover in the landscape may have a negative effect on merlin, and that's something that we have previously looked at and are continuing to, is that relationship with merlin and planted forest, because obviously, you know, across large areas of the merlin's breeding range in Ireland is now, you know, is now under forest cover.
Yeah, so it's all fine having all the nest sites you can sort of choose from, but if you've no foraging ground, you know, one without the other means no merlin. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose as well, it's because they are such a tricky species to survey, to locate. There's also the risk as well. Obviously, you know, nesting in commercial conifer plantation, that forest is managed. You know, so if there's, you know, merlin pairs nesting within the forest, if that forest is due to be felled or thinned, then there's obviously, you know, and if that's happening during the nesting season, then there's potential risk of disturbance to the to breeding merlin. And, you know, we have to say as well, you know, the vast majority of pairs nesting in commercial forest plantation, we just don't know where they are, because, you know, that they are such challenging species to find in the first place.
Definitely. So the Connemara dynamic is really interesting in that, like, talk about a perfect sort of situation for them. So small islands surrounded by freshwater lakes and perfect nesting, probably on what, likes of Sitka spruce or even in Scots pines, in old crow's nests on these islands, with all the forage and blanket bog you can imagine around, and then all the safety of the island.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're amazing places. And it's not even Sitka spruce. It's native woodland on these islands. So they're amazing, like pockets of like just oasis, and surrounded by then open blanket bog. But you're talking about, you know, really old oak, yew, rowan, birch, holly, you know, amazing, you know, very, very small pockets of woodland, but absolutely bursting, very, very verdant, bursting with life. And these are on the lakes as well, so they have, you know, a certain level of protection as well, you know, the woodland being on the inland lakes. And there are so many of these. We know Dermot Breen has led the work. He's done so much work in Merlin and Connemara, but our work focuses on actually checking all these islands to check if merlin are nesting on them, check if they're present. But they're ideal nesting sites. And the birds, we know that the birds have been there going back now decades, and you know, they move from one island to the next. Typically they typically don't use the same island year after year, but they have a lot of choice. And and that's one of the populations probably that we know most about, is the merlin in Connemara, and seem to be doing reasonably well, at least from what we've seen in recent years.
And tell me this, has there been any studies, or is there anything known about, like, are they found at a greater density in Connemara in that situation than they would be on the uplands and close to plantation?
So again, it's kind of, I suppose the limiting factor with merlin is that there's been so little work done on them that it's hard to draw comparisons, or, you know, the baseline really is missing in terms of, you know, their trends, their population size. There still are a lot of gaps in our knowledge of merlin. We have done some work recently in Connemara which has established breeding densities, and they have been slightly higher than what David Norris, who kind of was one of the pioneers of merlin work in Ireland. So the densities in Connemara were slightly higher than what David Norris would have found, kind of going back to the 80s, even the late 70s, into the 80s in parts. So he would have studied merlin in the Wicklow Mountains, Kildare, in Donegal also. So they seem to be doing reasonably well in Connemara, but it's again, it's quite an unusual population just because of the, you know, their nesting ecology there, and you know, other parts where we know merlin do occur, we just don't have that level of information. We've no, you know, great understanding as to, you know, their trends. Are they, you know, are they holding their own? Are they, or are they decreasing? You know, or you know, the population size, the national population size for merlin. That's just we just don't know.
It's tricky when you've no reference point, so you're wondering what you're trying to work back to. But I think I probably know the answer here. But then, I mean, I've seen numbers quoted of about 250 pairs sort of across the island. Does that sound right to you, or do you think it's far south of that, or is it much greater?
It's difficult to say. Yeah, and there's been other population estimates of 300 to 400 pairs, and it is very much that's, you know, best estimate based on expert opinion. That's, it's not you know, based on you know, a strategic survey or even extrapolated from sample areas. It's and to be honest, you know, it is difficult to hazard a guess, because so there are certain parts of the country that there has been, you know, quite focused merlin work carried out. And I mentioned some of the individuals involved: Dermot Breen and Angus O'Donnell in the Western Connemara, David Norris previously, and Anthony McGellerin in Wicklow, and that has provided information in those areas. But then there's huge parts of the country that, say, for example, I've always been really interested in the raised bogs in the Midlands, which are, look, you know, well, at least many of them look, you know, suitable for merlin. They look like there should be merlin there, but we just don't have a good understanding as to, you know, the numbers of merlin in those areas. And I think because they are so tricky, you really have to be carrying out really intensive focused surveys on merlin in order to establish whether they're there or not. So, you know, when I look at, say, for example, you know, the maps from the breeding bird atlases, like it only shows really a, you know, small part of the picture with merlin, because, you know, if you're just carrying out a general bird survey, you know, trying to record, you know, as many species as you can or other species, you know, the chances are you're just not going to pick up merlin. So I suppose, you know, we're still trying to figure out, you know, just the better handle of their distribution, and you know, and you know, at a national scale. So I think there definitely are still question marks over the national population size. We have carried out a survey within the SPA network, and that has given us some information in terms of breeding densities and numbers, but it's a small area of their national range, you know.
So on that, I mean, they're clearly a very, very, very tricky species to monitor and keep a handle on. But to do that, you've come up with sort of, well, maybe not come up with it, but you've started to utilise new technology to try get a handle on that and use these new technologies to in our favour to see what they're up to. So tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's the silver bullet just yet, but it definitely, from the from our experience so far, it definitely seems to be helping. So this season just gone now, for the first time, we used a drone with a thermal sensor to try and help detect merlin nests, to try and help detect breeding merlin, and it definitely seems to be a useful tool in the toolbox. And I suppose, just as I described, you know, some of the areas that you'd be naturally searching for merlin, you know, they're typically remote, you know, they're sometimes quite inaccessible, you know, quite difficult terrain to, you know, to navigate, to walk across vast areas. And say, for example, you know, if you picture places like Roundstone Bog and Connemara, you know, where they are nesting on the inland wooded islands, like there's just literally hundreds of those scattered across the bog. So very, very time consuming, hugely resource demanding to, you know, to check all those by conventional means. So we tried the drone with the thermal sensor for the first time, and yeah, it seemed to work very well for merlin. So the basis of it is that the, you know, the birds have they give off a stronger heat signal than their surroundings, because they're a higher temperature. So the thermal sensor allows us to detect that. So essentially the process was flying the drone over the areas that, you know, the search area, looking for these subtle cues, you know, to indicate that there was a nest or, you know, or something of interest. And then once we had identified that, to be able to zoom in and identify, you know, what species it was. And we found, you know, a whole range of other species, like, you know, nesting grey heron and hooded crow and, you know, other species like that. But we were successful in finding merlin nests as well. And probably, you know, with, you know, in much less time than we would have found them using, you know, the older, well, I wouldn't say the older methods because we still use them, which would be, you know, literally trudging across the bog in a wetsuit, hopping in the lake, you know, making your way over to the island, checking all the trees, looking for stick nests. So, which don't get me wrong, is a fantastic way to spend a spring summer day in Connemara, but it takes a long time to cover ground that way. So yeah, very exciting to see how this technology can be applied, and hoping to continue with it next year.
That's wild. That's great. I mean, geez, the old way, man, is, well, not the old way, but the kind of standard way is fairly serious now and intensive. But the drone, I presume, I mean, if it has a thermal sensor, it'd probably no hassle zoom right into the nest. You can probably even count brood numbers and eggs and all sorts, can you?
Yeah, absolutely. And picking up all sorts, like, you know, mammals as well from long distances away. And you can see, you know, from the behavior that they, you know, they weren't even aware that, you know, that the drone was in the sky, that we were looking at them, which is obviously what you want. But, you know, and from that perspective, it is really good because you're reducing disturbance, but you're, you know, getting the information that you want. And yeah, absolutely, you know, the zoom capabilities on it are absolutely incredible. So, you know, you could zoom in, you know, count the number of chicks in the nest, or, you know, the clutch size if it's earlier in the season. So yeah, really incredible in one sense, but somewhat scary as well, looking to the future when you see, you know, might potentially, you know, we'd be out of a job if we're not careful, you know, in terms of the more conventional survey methods.
Yeah, well, it was the first question I asked you when you originally told me about this was, can you pick up a heat signal in a wall of a swift nesting? And you said no, so I'm safe for another while, but you're out of a job shortly.
That's right. But I would say it does take a bit. You need to know what you're looking for to, you know, when you're flying over the area. So I don't think we'll be getting our
P-45s.
We'll be giving our notice. P-45s, that's what I was looking for. Yeah, just yet. So I think we're safe for a while.
You raised a point there. I think it's probably important that we mention it and flesh it out a bit. What's the, obviously, licensing implication? You can't just have any Tom, Dick or Harry fly their drone across the islands and start sort of disturbing birds and all. So what's the setup there?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I suppose it is, you know, developing technology. So it's one thing, you know, we're still learning, you know, what the potential disturbance effects are from the use of drones. And obviously, you know, there's huge benefits, just as I described, but also as well, you know, that there's also risks and, you know, the potential for disturbance of breeding birds, you know, using drones. So yeah, so as part of our work, obviously had to get licensed through National Parks and Wildlife Service. We only focused on two areas in the season just gone. That was Connemara as well as the Wicklow Mountains. And very, very careful, you know, it was a steep learning curve for us, so we were learning as we went. So very careful to monitor, you know, the potential effects on not just Merlin but other species as well. And I think we took a very cautious approach in terms of, you know, flying, you know, very high above the area that we were searching. And we were able to do that because of, I suppose, the zoom capabilities of the drone. But something that we're very conscious of, and I think something that we all need to be very conscious of going forward, that you know, to kind of ensure that any of the benefits of, you know, kind of advances in technology and survey techniques don't have, you know, negative consequences as well. But at least from what I've seen, I think, you know, very, very impressed with the capabilities of the drone and its application for particularly for Merlin. And I suppose if you think about it, you know, the increased ability to detect nests, you know, from a conservation perspective, that, you know, that really is a game changer for Merlin. Because, you know, continuing as we have been going in recent years of, you know, carrying out the survey methods, you know, with the so time consuming, resource demanding, you know, it really is only chipping away at it. And and I think in order, you know, that there needed to be, you know, changes, improvements in order to improve our understanding of Merlin. So I think definitely this technology will have a place. But, you know, as I said, this was the first season that we used it, and we're still learning. So hope to continue and to advance next season again.
Very good, excellent. That sounds very exciting. Tell me, just something popped into my mind, or do the adult birds have any sort of predators at all. Other, like, obviously foxes and stuff will take a go at them at the nest, but would a peregrine have a go at a merlin or anything like that?
It's a good question. To be honest, they're so incredibly agile that they seem to be, you know, quite safe just because of their agility, their maneuverability. So even though they're so small, what they lack in size, they make up for an attitude. And I've seen them, you know, fearlessly mob, you know, much larger birds like raven, you know, or species like buzzard, and, you know, totally safe in the knowledge that they, you know, that they can escape so easily, that they're so much more maneuverable. So in terms of from the adults, that's not to say that they wouldn't be taken, but in terms of in Ireland at least, predation of the adults, I don't think is an issue that would be, you know, affected at a population level. But predation of nests is definitely an issue, and we have, you know, from the pairs, say, that we monitor in Connemara and elsewhere, you know, we, you know, typically see, you know, each year, you know, nests lost to predation, and that's mostly, you know, tree nesting pairs as well. So, you know, mostly hooded crow would be predators of nests, you know, either at the egg stage or with young chicks. But in terms of the adults, no, it wouldn't be. There are birds taken by other larger raptors, but not to the extent that it would be a pressure on the population.
So I suppose my last question is, what are the future conservation issues for Merlin in that, like, just this week now, there's a lot going on. I mean, we're obviously mindful of the new forestry policy that's coming up and what's going to happen there with afforestation sort of targets and all that sort of stuff. Like, where does that sit with the species? The other one is, like, I mean, a lot of talk of just transition, Bordermona going from brown to green, all that sort of stuff, like the future of our bogs. Europe now are breathing down our necks again to prosecute about cutting the bogs and all that sort of stuff. So where do all those implications, policy and a national level leave Merlin in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you know, there's no doubt about it, there are a lot of pressures on our uplands, and there have been for some time. And I think, like, some of those factors that you mentioned definitely would impact Merlin populations. So, you know, disturbance activities in, you know, inner bogs or blanket bogs or raised bogs, you know, turf cutting, or, you know, even industrial scale, you know, peat extraction. So, you know, those reducing those pressures from our uplands, you know, can definitely have benefits for Merlin. I think afforestation as well, like, we are still trying to understand the relationship between Merlin and afforestation and planted forest. But I think, you know, like, the, you know, the upland areas which we see, because, you know, say for example, you know, some of our upland areas, like the Sleevoctes, for example, which is a special protection area in which Merlin is listed as a species of conservation interest, like, the majority of the Sleevoctes, in fact, under forest, so over 50% of it is under forest. So, you know, that from a Merlin perspective, from other species, you know, that is a lot of that area which is, you know, typically unsuitable for Merlin, even though, as I say, you know, they would actually nest at the edge of plantation. But from a foraging perspective, you know, that once the forest, you know, reaches maturity, those areas are essentially off limits for Merlin. So there are, you know, without a doubt, you know, significant pressures on Merlin populations in the uplands. And I think part of it as well is, you know, in order to understand that, we still, you know, that one of the I see pressures on Merlin populations is just lack of understanding of populations, of their trends. Like, you know, I found it very interesting, like, if we compare Merlin to hen harrier, for example, there's a lot of similarities. They're both Annex 1 species. They're both, you know, upland raptors, but they're light years apart in terms of our knowledge of the ecology of those species, in terms of the you know, the research and the conservation that have been focused on those species. And don't get me wrong, you know, that's all absolutely merited for hen harrier. Unfortunately, hen harrier is a species which is, you know, in decline. So if anything, we need more. But with Merlin, you know, we're not even at that level that we even know, at what state the status of the population is in. So I think that is one of the big, you know, factors that we need to change, and that does, you know, there's no denying it, that does take investment and that does take resources for Merlin, but they you know, it's definitely time to address some of those knowledge gaps, to answer some of those questions.
John, that's deadly. Loads to think about there. Great to put Merlin on people's radar. Think about the sort of the issues facing them and where it's at. And look, I learned heaps there. Thanks a million.
Thank you, Ricky. Pleasure as always.
As I always say when I listen to John, there's a man who knows his stuff and is really into it too. It's great.
I didn't have a clue about Merlin. I've only ever caught glimpses of them and yeah, they've just stayed elusive to me and I learned heaps. I think that's probably the episode I've learned the most from all the ones we've made.
It's fascinating because it's a species that we actually, until recently, didn't know all that much about. It has a huge range. You find them all across the Northern Hemisphere, so all across Europe, Asia and North America. But they have very different habits in different countries because they're different prey species. They have different nesting habits. Some of them are migratory, some of them aren't. I've even seen them in places like the Caribbean on migration. You wouldn't expect to see a bird like that in somewhere like Jamaica, but they're there as well. It's amazing how widespread they are. They're a very successful little bird.
Yeah, and it's good. And it's great to see John and others sort of utilising sort of state-of-the-art technology to monitor them and as a conservation tool now, which is just fantastic. And that drone technology and the thermal camera stuff is fascinating. And I'm really interested to see how that evolves over time.
Yeah, and it was a bird that, it's been celebrated for centuries. It was very popular for falcon. It was always known as the lady's falcon or the lady's hawk. So it was noble women would often go out riding on horseback with their Merlin on their arms. So it's got that strong association because despite their diminutive size, they really are ferocious little predators.
Yeah, absolutely, no, they are. They're great little things. Talking about their sort of their ferocity, if you're a meadow pipit, you don't want to tangle with one, and that is the topic of our bird of the week.
Yeah, the meadow pipit, a bird that I always think of as one of the bird watchers' birds. So we always come blasé about them. Once you're into bird watching, you go out a bit, you see a meadow pipit. Oh, it's just a meadow pipit. But for the average member of the public who doesn't know much about birds, meadow pipit is a mystery. They don't know this bird at all because it doesn't really come into our gardens. I have actually recorded it in my own garden for the Irish Garden Bird Survey, but that was a bit of a fluke. And it was actually eating spiders off the outside of my compost bin, of all things. But they don't come to bird feeders. Where you have to really go to where they are. So you often see them in the uplands, in moorland and heathland and bogland, exactly the kind of places you would find merlins. And then also, particularly in the winter, you'll find them along beaches, often on piles of rotting seaweed. There's a closely related bird there called a rock pipit, which you'll see. It's a bit darker. To describe what they look like, if someone asked me to describe what does a meadow pipit look like, it looks like a wagtail wearing a thrush costume to me. They walk around on the ground, they have a long tail like a wagtail, and they're the same family as wagtails, but they're brown above and heavily spotted on the chest and on the flanks as well, just like a thrush. So that's how I describe them.
That is so spot on. I've never heard that used before, but it is ideal. And that's how I will describe them forevermore. The important thing, before we forget, is the call. I mean, you're going to pick up a lot more meadow pipits if you learn the call. So here we are.
Go, and hence the name pipit. That's it, named after the call. And there's many pipit species around the world, but the meadow pipit is the default one, and it's the one that sort of all others are judged against, I suppose. We do get rare pipits turning up here, but you use the meadow pipit as your baseline for what they look like.
They're lovely wee things, and yeah, when you said you see them along beaches on rocks of or piles of seaweed, it's like Niall, don't say that because they're going to mix them up with rock pipits, and yeah, you will, but they are distinguishable actually, and I don't have a great eye for these things. Let's admit it, but you can. The rock pipit is sort of a greyer sort of job altogether.
It is. It's greyer. It looks sort of more muted. It's more camouflaged against the rocks. You'll find that the meadow pipits, when they're in that area, they do stick out a bit more. They look warmer. But the easiest way to tell them apart is by their leg colour. So meadow pipits have sort of pinkish flesh coloured legs, whereas the rock pipits, they have dark legs, almost black. So that's a really good way to tell them apart.
And do we see more gynas in the winter, or are they just resident species that don't move far, or do we know much about them in that sense?
There's a lot we don't know, and it's a bird that hasn't actually been the focus of as much ringing attention as many other species, partially because they're so widespread, but also it's not a bird that we tend to get many recoveries of, I believe. Now, having said that, we do know that there is a core Irish resident population, but it is joined in the winter by birds coming elsewhere from Europe. The bird actually has a very, very large range, but despite that, it doesn't have a variety of different subspecies that look very different to each other, so you can't really tell by looking at them if they've come where they've come from, if they come just across from Scotland maybe or from France, who knows. So it's a bird we need to learn more about. It's a bird that's very common and widespread in Ireland, although it has been declining to the extent that we are concerned about them. They do feature now on the Bocky list, and they are a bird that, although still numerous, they are declining, and that poses a problem for birds like the Merlin that depend on them so much, because I often think of the meadow pipits as being almost like, you look at like southern Africa for example, you think of the impala there as being the cornerstone of all of the ecosystem there. All the big predators feed on it. It's kind of the same with the meadowpipit. It's kind of the default food for some of our raptors and other creatures as well.
Absolutely. And just to put context, the Bucky is the Birds of Conservation Concern in Ireland list that's compiled every sort of 5 or 6 years. It demonstrates on a kind of traffic light system which birds are in bother and which ones are okay, get the green light and everything. But the meadowpipits are amber listed. And yeah, so we talk about movements there, but I suppose there must be local movements. So we see, like, I mean, when we talk about meadowpipits being the prey species for a lot of raptors and other birds, hen harriers will be one of those species. Merlin will be one of those species. And they're upland breeders in a lot of cases. And then in the winter, they spend time sort of in the lowlands, in the bogs and stuff. So would it be fair to say that there's a kind of seasonal shift from meadowpipits from the uplands down into the sort of lowlands?
Yeah, very much so, yes. And it often depends on the severity of the winter. But we're talking about a bird that predominantly feeds on insects and other small invertebrates. So if they vanish from an area, it has no choice but to move. And that's why we do see this movement down to the coast, where, they, as we said, they can be confused with the closely related rock pipit. The big difference, though, there is the rock pipit is only found around the coast. You never see them more than a few metres from the sea, whereas meadow pipits, you find them throughout the whole country. But yeah, there are these seasonal movements down to the coast. One of my favourite things about the meadow pipit, and it's reflected very much in its Irish name. The Irish name is Bonnell Trona Chuacha, which means nursemaid of the cuckoo. And that's because this is also the host species for many, many cuckoos. It's the one they probably pick on the most. So again, if you see declines in meadow pipits, that's why there are declines in cuckoos, because there's fewer places for them to lay their eggs. They obviously famously lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, particularly meadow pipits. And if there aren't enough meadow pipit nests for them to use, then there'll be fewer opportunities to produce new cuckoos. And that's why species decline, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a beautiful programme produced recently about the burren, and they had lovely footage of the cuckoo's nest, and it was indeed a meadow pipit's nest that they had occupied.
And the whole thing about the nursemaid of the cuckoo is you'll sometimes see this almost slightly pathetic view sometimes of seeing like a tiny meadow pipit feeding a massive young cuckoo, even though it's still a youngster. It's many, many times larger than its unwitting foster parent, and it looks like it's trying to, you know, the people have thought, well, look, it's taking care of it. It thinks it's its chick, and to fool the meadow pipits, what the young cuckoo does is it makes a call that sounds like a whole group of baby birds, like a whole clutchful, and this just spurs on this parental instinct in these poor meadow pipits, and they just feed this interloper, and then it heads off on its way to Africa, leaving them behind. They don't seem to make the connection at all.
It's gas. No, it is. But so we always try to recommend where people can try connect with these species. So I'd say we recently did an episode with our colleagues on Dublin Bay Birds Project, and we mentioned Bull Island. That's quite a good spot to see meadow pipits all year round. And also, I mean, closer to home for me, all the bogs around. I mean, we get them on Abileague's Bog, you see them in Clara Bog, you'll definitely get them up to Sleeve Blooms on all that blanket bog over the summer and stuff. So they're pretty accessible. Just you need to keep an eye out. They're not going around in sort of 10s and 20s. So if you see a little sort of a pied wagtail wearing a trush costume flitting around, they're quite active. They do get around.
They do get around, yeah. They're always running around the place, and they tend to spend most of their time on the ground. They will go into trees sometimes in low bushes, but they like to be on the ground. And one of the adaptations they have that you see with quite a lot of these ground-dwelling birds, larks would be another example, they have an almost ridiculously long hind claw. So like other passerines or songbirds, as we call them, they have on each foot, they have three toes pointing forward and one toe pointing back. And that toe that points backwards has a very long claw. And this is often associated with birds that spend most of their time running or walking along the ground on rough terrain. It seems to stabilise them and make it easier for them to get perches on the surface. And, you know, it's not so important for them to be able to perch high up in trees or anything like that.
Lovely hurling. I think that brings to the end another excellent episode. So thanks, Niall.
Just to finish, as we always do, by urging you please to join Birdwatch Ireland. As a charity, we really do need your support. We really are fighting the good fight to try and keep birds like meadow pipits and merlins thriving across Ireland. We can't do that without your help. So please go to birdwatchireland.ie and do what you can. We'd really appreciate it.
In Your Nature is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, and is edited by Ciarán O'Connor.